A thing about game theory today that's not really about games at all. Also, a thing about lemonade that's not really about lemonade. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Monday, the 25th of April. Great to have you along, everybody, as always. There is a whole lot of practical economics wrapped up in this election campaign. Economic populism, trade economics, immigration economics. I could go on, but I won't. There is also, all of a sudden, some economic and social science theory wrapped up in this thing, too. John Kasich and Ted Cruz struck a deal over the weekend, divvying up a handful of state GOP primaries to keep Donald Trump from getting their party's nomination. Political types are all over this story for the sheer horse raciness of it. Us? Well, for us, it's about something much better, something called game theory. Marketplace's Nova Sappho is on it.
Game theory is a fairly straightforward concept, a study of strategy.
When people have conflicting motives, what should they do in various difficult situations?
William Poundstone is the author of the book Prisoner's Dilemma, and that dilemma is actually an element of game theory. It posits that if two criminals are caught, it's in the best interest of each to confess before the other does. And paradoxically, it's in the best interest of both to keep quiet, to give them both the best chance of getting away with their crime.
In a prisoner's dilemma, you really don't want to be the one who does the cooperative thing when everyone else doesn't.
Here's how that's played out in the Republican primaries. Kasich and Cruz both want to win, but they're undercutting each other instead, and Trump wins. So this past weekend, they made a deal best explained in that classic film, A Beautiful Mind, when the character John Nash comes to an important conclusion about cooperation versus competition.
The best result comes from everyone in the group doing what's best for himself, right? Incomplete. Because the best result would come from everyone in the group doing what's best for himself and the group.
This is what's called sometimes a repeated prisoner's dilemma.
Kevin Zollman is author of the book Game Theorist's Guide to Parenting. He says in a repeated prisoner's dilemma, you avoid doing what seems best for you to achieve a collective goal. Cruz and Kasich agreed to do this over the weekend by staying out of each other's way.
By agreeing to cooperate, they end up in a situation where they can both benefit.
By unifying that anti-Trump vote. But if they do and force an open convention, it will likely be back to every man for himself. In Chicago, I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
All right, so there's a chance that my next phrase is going to rub some people the wrong way, but it's not really a stretch to say that for as good an artist as Beyoncé is, and she is, let's be clear, she's arguably a better businesswoman. Even people who aren't fans of hers probably know she's got a new album out, an hour-long movie to go along with it as well, Lemonade, it's called. The music is streaming on Tidal. You can buy it on iTunes. The film is on HBO. She is an enterprise. Sirona Elton teaches music business at the University of Miami. It's good to have you on.
Great to be here.
On the scale of economic and cultural power, right now, as of today, where is Beyoncé Knowles Carter, as she credits herself in this album?
Well, I'd have to say, what's the top number of that scale? Because that's pretty much where she sits right now.
It's kind of amazing how she's come from this band that was controlled by her father, for which she and her dad were criticized, to this force of commerce. I mean, that's the only way to describe it.
Absolutely. She is a force. And she's very much a self-made woman. Now she's got her hand in just about every aspect of the entertainment business. And she's really in control of all of it.
What is it, do you think, that gave her that control? I mean, she does a lot of stuff, right? She limits access to herself on interviews, and yet she has such spot-on timing with things like the Super Bowl and this and that, the Beyoncé album from 18 months ago or whatever it was.
Well, I think she's very successful. And once you are that successful, your business relationships start to change and you get to call the shots. You know, once upon a time when Destiny's Child was a young act, they didn't have that kind of control. Mm-hmm. But over the years, as she's built up her fan base, which translates into dollars, she's gotten into a position now where the kinds of deals she enters into are all very unique, very customly written just for what she wants, which give her a huge amount of say-so over everything that goes on.
There are so many questions about the production of this thing, not the least of which was she must have had like 1,000 people working on this, and yet there was not leak one.
I know it is pretty amazing, isn't it, how she manages to keep the details of her new upcoming projects confidential. I think people realize, you know, that if they have that amazing opportunity to work on a project for her, they're going to have to sign some kind of confidentiality agreements. And if they were to breach those agreements, they would never get to work with her again and possibly never get to work with anybody again, because it's a relatively small industry. And if people break the rules, you know, everybody else knows about it. So you'd have to be insane to take an opportunity like working on a Beyonce project and then break that confidentiality and possibly never work again.
Yeah. How do you suppose she learned how to be as business savvy as she is?
Oh, that's a really hard question. I mean, obviously, you know, she was exposed to the business savvy sense from her father at a young age. But I think she's a naturally curious person who has always seemed to express an interest in how things are done. She's not one of those artists that sits back and just lets others manage her, at least not from where I can see. And so I think she's just picked it up all along the way, sort of a natural intelligence combined with drive and interest to learn about everything.
Sarana Elton is a professor of music business at the University of Miami. Thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Whole lot of waiting around on Wall Street today. Big Fed meeting this week, corporate earnings as well. A recipe for traders biding time. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Venture capital, you know about it, right? Early investing in hopefully promising companies, potentially high reward, more often high risk with some losses. Venture capital firms and rich people usually are the ones doing it. But there is also something called corporate venture capital, when companies form investment funds of their own. Google has Google Ventures, Twitter has Twitter Ventures, Intel has Intel Capital. You get the gist. And it turns out corporate VC is quite the hot trend right now. Our senior tech correspondent, Molly Wood, is here to explain it all to me. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai. How are you?
I'm good. So listen, make me smart here. Talk to me about these companies doing venture capital. I don't quite get it.
It's a concept that's been around for about 60 years. It's a sort of a subset of venture capital.
Yeah.
But the tech companies really picked up this ball and ran with it. Intel started off about 30 years ago, really getting into corporate venture capital. Unlike investing other people's money, these companies obviously invest their own money in external startups. And there's basically two reasons. Either they are trying to make money back, or, and this has become a lot more common, especially in the last few years, they're trying to get a competitive advantage. They're trying to figure out a way that they can invest in startups that they have some control over, and so they can bring new ideas and new innovations in-house and not get disrupted by that startup that somebody else funded.
Which totally makes sense. Give me an example of one that's worked out pretty well.
Yeah, you know, one example is Comcast, which has become a really big corporate venture capital arm. And they invested heavily in 2009, 2011 in a company that did remote home security control. Then it was called iControl. And they turned around and made it their Xfinity Home product.
Hmm.
And so all of a sudden you saw Comcast saying, no, we can give you a remote monitoring system and home security. And that's because they had invested in this outside company. Now, some of them also do make a ton of money. Qualcomm was an early investor in Waze, you know, the turn-by-turn direction.
I live and die by Waze. You better believe it.
Well, you live in L.A., so yes, you do.
That's right.
And a lot of other people do, because Waze was sold to Google for $1 billion, and so Qualcomm did pretty well on
all
that
right.
one.
Yeah, so that's real money, though. But give me the landscape here. In the world of venture capital, how big is this internal venture capital stuff?
So it has been on the rise. Right now, it makes up about 13%, just under 13% of overall venture investments.
Hmm.
And in 2015, corporate venture arms put more money into startups than at any time since 2000. So it's really been gangbusters lately. It's been criticized as helping to drive up valuations. And we've heard that complaint a lot in the tech industry, especially. And just like the rest of the venture capital market, they're starting to pull back a little bit. They're actually, Intel is one of the largest. It's about a $5 billion fund, or estimated to be. And there are reports that they might cash out about $1 billion of that, just to sort of because the market is cooling. And if that happens, it could really accelerate the sell-off or the cooling.
So, all right, so this is a little bit sideways, but also with Intel, they're laying off 12,000 people. Hello?
And Intel's a really interesting case, right? Because here's a company that was looking for a strategic advantage, looking for a way to get into mobile or do something other than PC chips. And looks like maybe this $5 billion corporate venture capital arm didn't pay off, which is should be a warning sign to all these companies who have been jumping on this bandwagon. We're still seeing companies, crazy ones. You know, I got invited to an event at JetBlue to announce their new venture arm. 7-Eleven just launched one. No. Sesame Corporation is doing it. The Sesame Street people.
I know I said this last time you and I chatted on the radio, but Marketplace ought to launch one of these funds too. Not only should we buy Yahoo, we should launch a venture fund.
I think so too. You know, I have been stocking up my change jar for Yahoo, so I'm still on board with that plan, and I think we could do well in the venture. Why not? Everybody else is.
I'm with you, man. I'm with you. Molly Wood, she's our senior tech correspondent, lead banker for our venture fund as well. Thanks, Molly.
My pleasure.
It used to be that if you wanted to challenge a patent on a drug, you had to actually go to court, a slow and expensive business. So Congress created a fast track, a patent review board, which gets us to today at the Supreme Court of the United States. The justices heard arguments in a case that could affect drug patents. On one side, Big Pharma, which doesn't like the review board. On the other, organizations that want to bring down the price of prescription drugs for consumers, who are joined by a group not usually seen as being on the side of consumers, hedge funds. From the help desk at WHYY Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein explains that one.
Hedge funds are in this for the money. Their strategy is to challenge what they consider vulnerable or cosmetic patents and then bet that the drug company's shares will drop. In one case, traders challenged a manufacturer who wanted to extend a patent by introducing a rubber stopper, which had nothing to do with the underlying medicine.
I'm just curious as to whether it worked. If it worked, I think it's genius.
New York Law School professor Jacob Shurko says this strategy is perfectly legal. He says, by his count, hedge funds have brought 36 challenges like this. Tom DeLinge is general counsel for the biotech trade group. He says none of these cases have helped consumers, for example, by bringing generics to market.
We think it's a cynical ploy by those who contribute nothing to innovation to drape their efforts to make money in a cloak of concern for patients.
It's the federal government's responsibility to keep the pharmaceutical business competitive, but a lot of people feel regulators have fallen down on the job. That's created this opportunity for hedge funds, who can make money by challenging patents. Luigi Singales is a finance professor at the University of Chicago. He says now there's a financial incentive for traders to break up monopolies by taking on cases as absurd as the rubber stopper patent.
Because everybody else who is an expert on patents or expert of drugs, in one way or another, benefit from the system and so is not willing to challenge it.
Zingale says if these Wall Street traders can do some good by doing well for themselves, it's better than what we've got now. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Coming up,
Northern China needs water, but Southern China suddenly doesn't need it? How can you take something others also need just because you're the capital?
The haves and have-nots of Chinese H2O. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials off 26 points today, about a 10%, closed at 17,977. The NASDAQ down 10 points, 0.2%, 48.95. The S&P 500 gave back 3 points, a 10%. Ended things at 2,087. Newspaper publisher Gannett has made an offer to buy Tribune Publishing for nearly $800 million all in. Gannett owns USA Today. With Tribune, it would own the LA Times and the Chicago Tribune, to name just a couple. Gannett inked up almost 6.5% today. Tribune Publishing, or Tribune Publishing, take your pick, up a whopping 52%. Something to read in the paper today. Xerox reported weaker revenue. The copier and printer company dipped 13%. Hewlett-Packard Enterprise down 1.6% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 1.91%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Saturday Night Live is going to be a little more viewer-friendly next season. NBC Universal announced today it's cut about a third of the ad minutes out of the show, meaning two fewer commercial breaks and a couple more minutes for actual content. Other TV and cable networks are doing the same thing, you know, paring down advertising to try to keep viewers from fleeing to ad-free or subscription-based options. From our desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has that one.
NBC is trying to hold on to SNL's ratings and viewers, as those viewers have more options for watching the show not in real time, which increasingly means not with the ads that the show's sponsors have paid for.
It's definitely a move toward recognizing advertising clutter in network television.
Media analyst and author Jack Myers says this is mainly about holding on to desirable younger viewers who are
more likely to view on Hulu, on Amazon, or on iTunes or DVR after the fact. So it's a way of holding the viewers for longer viewing periods. You don't lose them in the commercial breaks.
But fewer commercial breaks means less ad sales for NBC. To make up some of that lost ad revenue, SNL will also push the what's advertising and what's the show envelope. So next season, a few select advertisers will pay to have SNL actors appear in sponsored content, pumping up their products and brands inside the show in a hopefully sort of funny SNL way.
You know, I think it's kind of ironic.
Jonathan Taplin heads up the Annenberg Innovation Lab at USC.
Parodies of advertising have played a large role in SNL, and now SNL will use their characters to actually be in advertising. I mean, they have to be a little careful that they just don't become total sellouts.
SNL has some experience with this. Show characters have previously appeared in standalone ads for Jeep and State Farm Insurance. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
According to its most recent census, there are 1.339 billion people in China, 20% or so of all the people on the planet. Problem is that China's got just 7% of the planet's fresh water, and there are hundreds of millions of people living in places that have officially been designated water scarce. The World Bank says water and the procurement thereof diverts more than 2% of China's gross domestic product. Not a happy thing in an economy very much in transition. So today, in the first of a series of stories about China's water problems, our man in Shanghai, Rob Schmitz, takes us to the northern part of the country where unchecked development means water is literally running out.
Every morning at 5, Yang Shufang wakes up and fetches water.
I bring a few buckets, enough for drinking or cooking.
Yang doesn't live in the remote countryside, and her water isn't from a village well. She lives on the 7th floor of a luxury condominium complex in Lintao, a city with nearly 200,000 people that's run out of water.
Right after Chinese New Year, water stopped coming out of the tap. Now we have to stand in line each morning with our buckets and wait for water to be delivered.
Lintao is in Gansu province in China's arid northwest, situated along a tributary of the Yellow River. The combination of a drought and a surge of urban development means the city's underground water supply has dwindled to dangerously low levels, leaving tens of thousands of people without access to our most precious resource. Experts fear Lintao could be a sign of things to come.
400 Chinese cities now face a water shortage. 110 cities face a severe water shortage. This is a very serious problem.
Liu Changming is a retired hydrologist for the Chinese Academy of Sciences in Beijing. He advises China's leaders on water policy. He says all of these water-scarce cities are in northern China, home to 500 million people and a region that contributes nearly half of China's economic growth.
When I first arrived to Beijing 60 years ago, there were springs everywhere. Some bubbled up half a meter high. But now the population has increased sevenfold, and there are 7 ring roads around the city. That abundant water is gone.
China's former Minister of Water Resources, Wang Shucheng, has predicted at current rates of water use, Beijing, home to more than 20 million people, will run out of water in 15 years. Thing is, Wang said this 11 years ago. And that's why China's constructing the world's largest water transfer project at the cost of more than $60 billion. In all, 2,700 miles of man-made waterways will draw water from China's southern rivers and send it north, the equivalent of building a cement river that takes water from New York City and delivers it all the way to Los Angeles. Two of the three segments of China's South to North water diversion project are completed. Beijing began receiving water a year ago from the project's middle segment, a man-made waterway that draws water from the Han River, an important tributary of the Yangtze flowing through central China. The city celebrated the arrival of hundreds of billions of gallons of water as crisis averted.
Northern China needs water, but southern China suddenly doesn't need it? How can you take something others also need just because you're the capital? This is not just.
Journalist Dai Qing is author of Yangtze Yangtze, an investigation into the damming of China's biggest river. She says the state of her country's water, its scarcity and its toxicity, is the greatest danger facing China today.
Every year, the groundwater in northern China drops by a meter. 1 meter per year. That's frightening. But diverting water from the south is not the answer. It will alter nature, and it absolutely should not be done. We are not smarter than nature, nor are we more powerful.
Hundreds of miles south of Beijing, along the Han River in Hubei province, farmers return from the fields after a day's work. Since the South to North water diversion project began, the water level in the river has dropped, says farmers Li Kaiding and Wu Tianzhong.
It's dropped so much that big ships can no longer navigate the river. Nobody told us the water level was going to drop. The upper level of the government notifies the lower level, but we're farmers, and nobody tells us anything.
I asked them what they think of the project. Before they can answer, a farmer whose dander is up launches into a screaming fit.
What does it matter what we think? We have no say anyway. No matter how good the policies from Xi Jinping are, the local government always messes it up.
Back in Lintao, the northern Chinese city that has run out of water, local officials have found a familiar solution. With the city's groundwater tapped out, the city is building a water diversion project, a pipeline that will draw hundreds of millions of gallons of water from the surface of the Tao River to meet the needs of the city's 200,000 residents. I asked county manager Lei Yongping what kind of impact that'll have on the already parched Tao River.
It won't have any impact whatsoever. This has been certified by experts. If the experts didn't determine this, we wouldn't be building this pipeline.
I ask Lei where these experts were when his city ran out of water. A propaganda official at Mr. Lei's side jumps in to save him. Bian Dongsheng blames Lintao's water crisis on a sudden influx of new residents to the city. His answer raises even more questions. I ask Bian why the leaders of a city with barely any water allowed a sudden population spike.
Our country is designated a national poverty alleviation region, and the central government requires us to move these people to the city to lift them out of poverty and raise the urbanization rate. We can't allow these people to drag down the central government's goal of building a moderately prosperous society by 2020.
Bian's slogan-filled answer is fit for a propaganda poster. Moderately prosperous society is the official lingo for President Xi Jinping's goal to urbanize China. And the pressure from China's leadership on rural communities like this to urbanize, explains Bian, means Lintao has run out of groundwater.
Our economy must develop very, very fast. This is a central government policy. Only this way can we bring our people out of poverty. Our government is trying our best to restore water to Lingtao, but the momentum of economic development will not be stopped. No force can stop it.
Not even, insists Bian, the force of nature, as more and more humans compete for a dwindling supply of water. In northern China, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out today, about which I am quite frankly appalled. Cracker Jack has been putting toy prizes in its boxes of caramel-coated goodness for 125 years, but No more. Frito-Lay, the purveyor of said caramel-coated goodness, is going to replace the toy prizes with stickers containing digital codes that'll get customers into baseball-inspired games they can play on their phones. I get progress and everything, and I love my phone, and I'm a baseball fan, but this is not right. I mean, think about the song, right? Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack. Nobody's going to buy Cracker Jack anymore. The Dow off 26 points, a 10%. The NASDAQ down 10 points, 0.2%. The S&P 500 gave back 3 points, a 0.1%. Our daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Bridget Bodner, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.